Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I can't quit you, babe. But I got to put you down for a while. Well, you know I can't quit you, babe. But I got to put you down.
Hello, everyone. I'm Patrick Connor, and welcome back to Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. Doing another boxing history edition of the show today with my buddy Bren Jonathan Butler, who will be with us in just a moment. Needless to say, the boxing history business is more or less necessary since we're deprived of live boxing for the moment, and hey, we get it. We hope everybody's staying safe, by the way. We hope everybody is able to hole up and kind of just stay the hell away from everything as much as possible right now. But in the meanwhile, we're hoping to also entertain you. We're hoping to walk you through some boxing history in a fun way, of course, as we try to do. But today we're talking about controversial decisions in the history of boxing. A lot of them are going to be somewhat recent, though. So that's kind of nice. It's I know that on the boxing history episodes, I go pretty deep sometimes. I can literally go back to the 1700s every so often. Not that often, but every so often. And today, I think we're not going to be going that far back, which I think lends to a little bit more nostalgia for a lot of people, a little bit more personal nostalgia. They're able to personally remember how they felt when they heard about a lot of these decisions, or perhaps were there for them. And you know, some of these decisions are far enough back, though, that you know, maybe 30 years, some of them 30, 35 years, and yet even a few decades later, I mean, that's just recent enough so that it's something that I could potentially remember, somebody just a little bit older than me. And even so, over the course of 3-4 decades, a single decision gets talked about that much is it's significant. Obviously, it's going to come attached to a significant fight as well. Usually, it's a super fight or something along those lines, and it's understandable because a lot of people usually aren't going to be talking about little club fights and things of that nature in the same regard decades later. But nonetheless, controversial decisions. And what is it about boxing that just lends itself to controversial decisions? And this is something that comes up fairly frequently in the belly gazing conversations on boxing message boards and stuff like that. And I've seen everything from, well, now we have an even number of rounds, and that means that just mathematically it's more likely to have draws and more likely to have a result that is not definitive or less definitive. I'm not 100% sure how true that really is, given how many different ways there are to lose points in boxing. Whether it's knockdowns or whatever. But anyway, something about boxing and controversial decisions. And Bren, something about controversy. We like controversy, don't we?
We like controversy. It's all we want to deal with right now.
Are you walking somewhere?
I'm walking down the stairs of my apartment building to get outside to ingest the last legal drug of nicotine.
Well, legal there anyway, because legality here on the West Coast is a little different.
Yeah, that's true. I guess it is more prohibitive over there. But now I've got some sunshine, so I'm ready. I'm ready to go. There's a coffee vending machine, and as everybody should know, vending machines make everything taste better. So coffee, American spirit, some patriotism.
Hey, do me a favor and call right back in, because you're, like, clicking or something like that on your phone.
Sure.
Okay, call right back in. Yeah, I probably wasn't the only one that could hear the click, click, click when when he called in, but that probably won't do. That'll be a little bit too much. But yeah, that's our buddy, author, filmmaker, Bryn Jonathan Butler. Good dude. Sure will help make for a good time with me today. Let's see here. There he is. Okay, I can
better?
Already say that. Yep, way better. It just caught some weird frequency or something like that, and it was like click, 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 click. That wasn't going to do.
No.
Okay. So.
So we got some controversy.
Man, I don't know what it. It's not us. Like, it's not specifically us. It's boxing. We didn't do this. We're not creating the controversy. But I do admit, you know, I think that it's something that is easy to write about. You know, that kind of drama and controversy. It's something that is those kinds of feelings, the feelings of like seething fucking anger and stuff like that when you hear a decision that you just know is not correct, or perhaps you just feel really passionately is not correct. You know, those kinds of things are easy to write about, I feel, or if not easy, it's easy to capture those emotions. And boxing just delivers, like, time and again, man.
Oh, I think so. And I mean, some of these ones that we're going to cover today, I think why we get so wrapped up in it in boxing is to go the 12 rounds, or we're going to look back at some 15 round fights. And some of these careers are never the same as a result of what these guys laid at the altar of a given night and ended up coming short or getting a draw, maybe, or you think Castillo Mayweather won. I mean, the debate still lingers about who really won that fight. How would Mayweather's career have changed? How would boxing have changed as a result of one decision? You know, maybe one bad night or one injury that was there that kind of changed the course of how that person was able to perform. So there's just so much to play with these controversial decisions that still linger on. I mean, for decades, some of these get more complicated with time to revisit them, or just more fucking annoying. So it's a fun topic to jump into.
Is there a particular decision that kind of like nags at you, or something you like talking about, or somebody brings it up and you're like, oh God, you know, something like that?
Well, Leonard Hagler is the obvious one. I think also Hearns Leonard, the war, the rematch that they had after the first fight, which was so brutal, and what Hearns had to do to come back to put in that performance for 15 rounds and get to draw, Leonard getting a 2-point round, I think, in the 15th. You know, those are a couple. I was extraordinarily frustrated with the Lennox Lewis Evander Holyfield first fight. Not because it was a particularly exciting fight, even though I think Lewis said that Holyfield was one of the toughest, if not the toughest opponent that he faced, but just, you know, you just want guys like Holyfield and John Ruiz at that time to get out of the way so that some of the mega fights could have happened. And in both of their cases, they just wouldn't go away. You know, I did not want to see Lewis Holyfield as a rematch. And what it said about boxing in terms of Don King likely playing a role in it. I mean, I think also the most controversial of all time is that Chavez knockout victory against, just jump in there and give me his name, that incredibly fast fighter.
Oh, Camacho or?
No.
Oh,
no, the
oh,
one, there's a Legendary Nights about it.
Oh, Taylor. Yeah.
Yeah, of course, Medrick Taylor. Yeah, just slipped my mind. So, I mean, maybe that's the most controversial one of all time emotionally for me, just because Taylor was never the same after it, and it just seemed so amazingly unfair to stop it. And yet, I can also see a little bit of the other side of it. He was definitely in real danger, but God, I mean, just seconds left after that performance, and to know that the life is never going to be the same. You know, it's just the stakes of boxing with controversy that elevate it more than any other sport. You know, to lose a Super Bowl, 49ers have been my team forever, and to see them lose a Super Bowl, it's incredibly frustrating. But they're going to come back next year, and what are the stakes ultimately? it's just not the same with boxing, where these guys can be quite literally never the same, you know, and change the tenor of their career so dramatically after one of these losses, the emotional damage and impact and physical and spiritual. So those are a few of mine. What are some of yours?
No, I think that those are pretty good ones. And I mean, for whatever reason, there are a number that, well, not for whatever reason, I know the reasons, and most of the reasons why are things that I was talking about before with nostalgia and just being able to kind of remember how I felt or what I felt at the time. But there are a lot of like really egregious ones or ones that I thought were just so bad in the time. Like at the time, I remember watching Emmanuel Augustus versus Courtney Burton and what was happening. And it was just kind of like, it wasn't even so much like the stakes weren't nearly as big as perhaps some major world-class fight or something like that. But it became apparent fairly early on watching that, for instance, that whoever the fuck was in charge of what was going on here in the state of Michigan was not about, you know, like allowing Emmanuel Augustus to like operate. It was, they were just not having it. They didn't give a shit. What was what? They were just like, nope, whatever you got to do, shut this cat down. And that's pretty much exactly how it played out. So watching that, I just remember watching that and feeling so like, I mean, it's dumb because it's on TV in boxing, and I had absolutely zero involvement or investment beyond my eyes, you know, and being a fan. But for whatever reason, I just remember being so pissed and just being like, I cannot believe they're literally blatantly doing this shit right out in the open on video, right in front of everybody. Then again, you know, it kind of pales in comparison to the things that we see others in authority do right out in the open on video these days. But nonetheless, I just remember feeling like you're watching a crime being committed right there. And literally, it's like a state-sanctioned crime. So, like, what the fuck do you do? And anyway, that one, I just remember that sticking out to me, and then Teddy going nuclear afterwards at the Michigan official who didn't know the difference between a majority decision and split decision and all this sorts of stuff. It was pretty compelling TV, actually. It was just so fucking egregious and ridiculous. But, you know, on higher levels, like on obviously that's just not that high level. I do remember feeling at the time that Jose Luis Castillo beat Floyd Mayweather in their first fight. I probably at the time on message boards used things like kicked his ass, you know, used words like kicked his ass, fucked him up, Floyd's a pussy, you know, things like that, because that was definitely how probably like, you know, whatever that was, like 20, 19-year-old me would have spoken on a message board. But that is obviously not the case, and we were able to see in hindsight that Floyd probably did better in the fight than a lot of people at the time gave him credit for. But we also got to see Jose Luis Castillo, we got to see that he was a very good fighter. We got to see that he did a lot more against Floyd Mayweather than a lot of other pretty good opponents were able to do.
Oh, I mean, Castillo is breathtaking. And that first fight, I mean, you can just see Floyd, and I think it's the only time where, as sophisticated a fighter as he was, with, you know, plan A through probably, you know, J or K, he just didn't have an answer for the willpower that was coming at him and the amount of energy and ferociousness that Castillo was able to muster. And you know, he was doing his best to survive, but I mean, it's one of the rare times where you can see Floyd unable to use his gifts and his intelligence and ring generalship to dominate another fighter, where the other fighter is feeling, boy, it's just so hard to gain any advantage without taking risks that Floyd so easily takes advantage of. And in that fight, you could just see Floyd on his back foot and too many punches coming his way to effectively counter, so that you knew Floyd had to have it in his mind. I just don't have an answer for this round after round after round, and he just keeps coming. And he took a lot of shots in that fight too. So I know after the fight he claimed there was some injuries that he was sort of struggling with that limited him, and full credit to Floyd coming back in the second fight and winning a much more decisive victory. I don't know many people who contend that Castillo won the rematch, but it also, I think, underlined that just stylistically and in terms of the kind of condition and determination that Castillo had, Castillo was, you know, I think the greatest opponent that he ever had. And that first fight, I think it's very interesting to think, had the judges seen it, certainly the way the HBO hosts did, where, I mean, it seemed to everybody there, Lampley, Harold Letterman, and the crowd, too many people who saw that as a Floyd victory, and certainly not the way Floyd framed it, where he seemed to suggest it was very clear in his mind that he won the fight. It seemed over the course of that fight, his corner and just his face throughout it, he knew he was in some real jeopardy of losing his first fight. And without that O, it's very hard for Floyd to make any of the arguments that he did, that he was, you know, the best ever. And, you know, and I think it would open up a lot more debates in terms of Sugar Ray Leonard or Hearns, or had he fought any of the great comparable people in the weight classes where he fought, how he would have done in those fights. So it's a real game changer.
Yeah, in this era, or in, I guess I should say that era, because it was now a totally different era. That shit was in 2002. 18 years, mm-hmm. Holy shit, goddamn. But it literally was, you know, pretty close to this era. You know, when one loss means so much, not being able to sport that O, and, you know, that O became a large part of Floyd's, if not success, at least perceived success. That might not have had really too much to do with it in reality. But, you know, I mean, yeah, it's a lot of it's just perception, as we know, and we're able to directly point to other eras and other great fighters who lost to know that the loss doesn't mean everything, but preserving that loss was fairly important. And I think that one of the interesting things about that fight is, in a lot of these instances in which a lot of people could point to and say, oh, Floyd didn't do that well, or he was hurt, or something like that. You know, basically, in those instances, you can point directly to that and say, oh, well, you can look at his face, and it's almost like he's playing with his victim. You know, it's like a cat playing with its prey or something like that. And it's not all the time. But in this fight, it was different. In this fight, he definitely looked like, I don't want to say panicked, but he had a different look on his face than you can see in a lot of other fights. He had a look on his face like, fuck, dude, like, this guy's pushing me. Whereas in other fights, it just, to me, it seems like he's, like, for instance, against the against Victor Ortiz, many people have felt since then, or have remarked since then, oh, Floyd was in real trouble. He was getting caught up real bad. But then when you see the kind of close-ups with Victor Ortiz having Floyd on the ropes and kind of just flailing away, you can see the close-ups of Floyd's face, and he's sitting there smiling literally the entire time. You know, he might get, like, caught, like, here and there a little bit, but he didn't seem hurt, didn't really seem particularly affected at all. And my point is, against Castillo, it was different. He looked different. He had the look of a guy who was trying to say he wasn't hurt or trying to say he wasn't affected. And that, the old, you know, when you say it, you're definitely affected thing. And that's what it looked like to me. He had trouble with Castillo's body punching, and where Floyd was able to kind of keep him on the outside for the most part, in the first handful of rounds, he was still taking shots to the body. And Castillo was able to put body shots better on him better than just about anybody else in Floyd's career. And that really made the difference in that fight for me. Anyway, I remember at the time just being like, oh man, no, that's a Castillo fight for sure. But I also kind of fell into the kind of stereotypical trope of, you can't win a fight running away type of shit, which I now am, you know, I'm not much of a believer of anything like that, or like you have to beat the champion to take us, you know, no, you just have to win the fight. So it's possibly me maturing a little bit and me coming to understand, me being a little bit more level-headed in my assessment of a fight, but nonetheless, I do remember also at the time feeling that that was like, that was an injustice. But Floyd did come back in the rematch, which perplexingly was scored more closely than the first fight.
Yeah, and I think there's also some other ways to examine this fight, because I agree. I think Floyd showed more vulnerabilities in that fight than he ever did in the rest of his career. And I mean, Rocky Marciano looked vulnerable a lot of times in several fights of his career. It was not a cakewalk for him to get to 49-0 or 48-0. But Floyd showed, you know, big guts to hang in there against an incredibly game opponent, a very dangerous opponent, who I think had the energy to be quite a bit more active, throwing and landing far more punches than Floyd in that fight. The punch stats looked like it was a pretty demonstratively clear victory by Castillo. But I mean, it's one of the things that makes Floyd, you know, the kind of, allowed him to have the kind of career he did. He faced real adversity. He did his best. But I also think it offers a window into that examination of him being one of the all-time greats, is that you look at Sugar Ray Leonard when he's really been pressed, when the chips were down, he was willing to take big risks. And Floyd really didn't take a big risk in that fight. He hung in there, but you didn't see him pushed into greatness to dominate Castillo when he felt the threat. I'm not saying he played it safe, because, I mean, he was still putting on a hell of a fight to defend himself against the onslaught that Castillo was mounting round after round after round, being so active. But you didn't see him, you know, change course in order to have the ability to dominate Castillo and risk something to dominate Castillo. He survived that fight. It was survival. And Theo, one of the all-time greats. No, and this was Floyd in his prime. So I think when we look at Leonard or, you know, many of the other great fighters, when they really get pushed, this is something that we want to look for in great fighters, is showing us greatness. And Floyd didn't have it in that fight. We didn't see greatness. We saw a very, very good fighter find a way to win in a controversial fashion. But, you know, it was not kind of how I felt what he achieved against, like, Sugar Shane Mosley, taking some brutal shots in the second round of that fight and turning it around and then dominating. Floyd never had the ability to dominate Castillo. He had the ability to controversially win the first fight and then pretty clearly win the second fight, but it was not a dominant performance. And it is something that when I talk to sort of old timers about, I was just talking yesterday to Don McRae, interviewing him for my podcast, about what was it like to work on Dark Trade, which was covering the years 91 to 94 or 95, of seeing Roy Jones at his prime and spending time with Jones, going to Pensacola. Where do you see Roy in terms of seeing him at his peak, and how did the losses sort of affect that legacy? And he just said, I think Roy Jones is a fighter defined by never having that opponent to really push him and to see greatness. You saw greatness in his ability, but you didn't see it demonstrated in any one particular fight. He just didn't have those epic battles the way Ali was tested and a lot of other great fighters were tested. And I mean, we can debate that. I think what Roy did against Bernard Hopkins early on and Tony, even though Tony, we need to look a little bit at what was required for him to get down and weight and stuff like that. But I think Floyd is in a similar position in that he showed his greatness in the opponents he picked, fighting them when he did, and masterminding his career. But in terms of the legacy he left in the ring, you know, he earned everything he did to put himself in the position to get these massive paydays. But he, since he's left the game, is not a fighter that many people are going back to these fights for how thrilling they were in terms of legacy. So it's an interesting aspect of how to assess his career, I think. And the Castillo fight kind of underlines it, the first one.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, he definitely was not. You could look at his record, and you can basically just ask a fairly simple question: what's more likely? Is it more likely that he was so good that he made the vast majority of his opponents look so bad, or is it more likely that he just had a combination of not as good an era to deal with and also the ability to choose his opponents? Like, what's just more likely? You know, and the latter is obviously much more likely, and that is what happened. And it's okay to acknowledge it. And it's also okay to acknowledge that other fighters in other eras just were dealt a deeper pool of talent, you know, to deal with. And that's okay. You know, it's not Floyd's fault. It's just a fact.
Yeah, I think that's it. And I think, you know, it's another aspect of what is left behind from the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight, which is now where we're just out of 5 years since it happened, is I think a lot of people, if they're honest, if they think what would have happened in that fight if it happened 4 or 5 years earlier than it did, there's still a lot of question marks about how different that fight would have looked. And I think most people see that it was Floyd that did not want that fight when Pacquiao was at his peak. So on the one hand, you can say, what a shame that we didn't see these two guys when it would have been a much more competitive fight and maybe a much more dangerous fight for Floyd. Could have pushed them both towards, you know, one of boxing's greatest fights of all time. On the other hand, if you're looking at it from a business perspective, you can say what a genius Floyd was that by the time the fight did happen, Pacquiao had to capitulate on almost every level in order to make the fight happen. And Floyd dictated all of the terms. Pacquiao had this incredible loss to Marquez after the fourth fight. And, you know, Floyd got it at a time where he could just punk Pacquiao very easily. So it's interesting. You know, Floyd's career is a very, very interesting one. I don't know how many more fighters are going to be able to come along and take advantage of the blueprint that he established, but God knows Floyd took advantage of it. But it also is a mixed legacy. It's one that if you measure it by money, there's no question about how successful it was. But if you measure it by the legacy that most fight fans seem to have about the great fighters, it's mixed results.
And it's, you know, beauty, I guess, is in the eye of the beholder, as it were. And it's a similar concept here, really. You know, it just depends on how much you like either guy or whatever. In this case, Floyd is just not particularly likable beyond his money.
No, he's not a likable fighter. But, I mean, he had the genius to recognize that and market himself as an unlikable fighter, to transform probably into a caricature of his worst character aspects. And that was his genius. And that was a genius he possessed, you know, and an insight that he possessed that was infinitely more marketable than a lot of Ivy League types, you know, who were promoting him, who didn't recognize its potential, didn't recognize the demographics that Floyd saw. So he deserves a lot of credit for that. But, you know, the matchmaking to create relatively boring fights that he was able to dominate or take advantage of has not left us with, you know, I don't think HBO is really clamoring for a lot of legendary nights starring Floyd Mayweather as a result of the fights he put on.
Now there's, well, that would probably be just about the only one, the Castillo fight or the two Castillo fights or something like that. And I'm not really sure that they're meaty enough to really want like a legendary nights about them. I mean, it's, I don't know. That would be a bit of a stretch. But another controversial fight that I think that obviously deserves mention from about 10 years earlier, and it came up semi-recently when Pernell Whitaker had died. It was obviously one of the fights that people talked about most in the wake of his death, and that was his draw with Julio Cesar Chavez in 1993. It was a little bit before my time as far as being an actual boxing fan. I do remember hearing about it on the news, but not much. And even so, I was like 10 at the time, so I would not have been old enough to form a real, you know, informed opinion or anything like that. But nonetheless, that kind of injustice, I guess you could call it, is something that wound up probably defining Pernell Whitaker's career a little bit too much, like disproportionately, because he actually did accomplish a lot of things. And it wasn't just about having a shitty draw against Julio Cesar Chavez, but that's another controversial decision that lives on for however many years.
Oh, no question. I mean, a huge controversy in the aftermath of that fight. You know, big money on the line for that. I think Chavez made in the neighborhood of $5 million. Sweet Pea made $3 million. You know, Chavez has this patently absurd record of 87-0 going into the fight. And, you know, what a matchup of styles between them. I mean, the perennial Mexican fighter in Chavez and just one of the most slick, sophisticated fighters that boxing has ever seen, a defensive genius in Pernell Whitaker. And yeah, I scored that one for Sweet Pea pretty clearly. But yeah, that did a lot of damage. Certainly Lou Duva took a lot of issue, launched official protests, you know, right after the fight. You have, you know, the controversy surrounding the WBC appointed judges in that. I think two of them were appointed. King had controversy before with another Duva fighter, with Medrick Taylor, like we were talking about, with a very controversial ending with the referee stopping that fight and the referee having a business relation, or his wife having a business relationship with King, them having some ties. So not a good look for boxing on that one. I mean, how did you score it? I just, to me, it looked like a pretty clear victory. I mean, Sports Illustrated doesn't often put a headline as unambiguous as robbed immediately after the fight, unless there's a lot of support for that opinion.
There was definitely a lot of support for that opinion. And I mean, there was so much support for that opinion that it was even a kind of ground swelling of, well, not even, that's probably downplaying it. It was more than a groundswell. It was a tidal wave of support for Pernell Whitaker, even in the Latino community, even in the Mexican, especially like border communities. And I, not long after Pernell Whitaker had died, I wrote something about it. And when I was researching for what I wanted to write, one of the things that I had found was that immediately after that fight, in Texas, this reporter had gone and watched the fight at a theater. And the being that it was Texas, this theater was comprised of like 90% Mexican fans, and that colloquially, everybody was cheering for Whitaker or rooting on Whitaker or going, oh, that was bullshit, when they left. And I mean, that's anecdotal, of course, but I think it's also kind of representative of what a lot of people felt, and that they saw Pernell Whitaker clearly outdo one of the best fighters in the world. And, you know, Pernell Whitaker and Julio Cesar Chavez were pound for pound number one and two in the ring for like 2 or 3 years. And it was a fight that was stylistically a kind of, I don't want to say stereotypical, but it definitely fell under the umbrella of like the quintessential stylistic, you know, boxer versus puncher type of matchup that a lot of fans need, and that the kind of contrast that some really great fights have had. And beyond that, they were within a weight, you know, within a weight division of one another, and it made sense. And that doesn't happen very often. And you know, you just mentioned Floyd Mayweather versus Manny Pacquiao, and so for that, for instance, you know, that in like 2008, 2009, for them to both be at 147 pounds, at or about 147 pounds. And for that not to happen, and they're like pound for pound number one and two for however many years, you know, that was the problem. And that was why it was however many years too late. I don't think that Whitaker Chavez was late really by any means. It was pretty much right on time, and the fight had been built perfectly. So this was a massive fight. This was not just some random ass fight. It was just huge. But everybody saw Pernell Whitaker outdo this guy who was perhaps, you know, according to the ring, the best pound-for-pound fighter in the world, and at the very least, a very potent body puncher, you know, a very good offensive fighter who made mincemeat out of a whole lot of opponents. So Pernell Whitaker was able to handle this guy and tame him, and yeah, that cover of Sports Illustrated robbed, and then the very next time that Pernell Whitaker wound up being on the cover of Sports Illustrated, it said in big letters, pound for pound, because he had recovered from that draw and, you know, really worked to get back into the good graces of the boxing gods or whatever. And, you know, Pernell Whitaker was a fucking legend.
Oh, he was, yeah, extraordinarily special. And I want to make it clear, like, I didn't think that Pernell Whitaker won it because I, you know, disliked Chavez in any way. I'm a huge Chavez fan. I love that style. But I you know, that was what was so thrilling about that fight, was to see one of the greatest offensive fighters ever, just the most tenacious, I mean, almost mythically offensive, and just everything you want in a balls-to-the-wall puncher. Just so tenacious against such a wizard. I mean, I think you'd have a good argument if you made Pernell Whitaker was the greatest defensive fighter ever, certainly in the top three, I think would be really difficult to argue against. So it had everything you want in a matador and a bull going at each other. And I think it did offer a tremendous contest between the two of them as they're trying to work each other out. But it, you know, it will go down just as you say, is one of these incredibly controversial fights, and in a bad way, because I think just the politics of boxing and King and Suleiman and the WBC, I mean, that stuff that is not what we're looking for out of, I think, good controversies where there are differing opinions, but we're not looking at these outside forces mitigating the result, as it seemed to be in the case of this one.
Yeah, there was. It's tough because, and it's something that I actually wanted to ask you about from the onset, but I tend to, when weird decisions happen, and obviously there are going to be outliers here and there, but when weird decisions happen, more often than not, I tend to go with ineptitude over corruption. It just makes more sense for me. But that being said, the corruption doesn't really have to be that, like, thorough or deep, or, you know, it doesn't have to be a big winding conspiracy. It really only has to be that, I mean, dude, you've been around boxing. You've been around boxing people, and you know how many people are friends with judges and commissioners and promoters, and I mean, like, writers, editors, whatever, and the people that they write about, you know, and are buddies with them and hanging out with them after writing about them and shit. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily saying that these are bad people or doing evil things, but I'm just saying that, like, the community is so small that the corruption doesn't have to be this big winding conspiracy. It can just be something as simple as, you know, you hang out with this person whose fight you're judging, or who's, you know, who's promoting the fight that you're judging or something like that. So, you know, it's something to think about. But my question is, what do you view these things as when you see them?
Well, I agree with you. I think, you know, boxing has been famously corrupt almost from its inception. I mean, it's beginning with slave owners putting hoods on slaves and having battle royales and them chucking money at the last guy standing. I mean, it's not a pretty foundation for us to begin from. And, you know, thereafter, you know, there's been controversy almost in every great era. You know, defining controversies seem to be the fights often that people most talk about. And, you know, one of the most controversial decisions that we haven't really touched on even is, you know, maybe the defining fight in Roy Jones Jr.'s career was the most egregious theft of a boxer in history, not just amateurs, but I think in total, with three judges being banned and an unbelievably clear victory being stolen from him. And Jones was still really raw about that decision when I talked to him as a much older man,
yeah.
I mean, in his late 40s, saying, I almost gave it all up. I mean, that was almost it for me. If I can't get a victory for that kind of performance, what the hell am I doing in this sport? And, you know, everybody, even the people who are kind of famous for avoiding corruption, like a Customato, standing up to the mob and that kind of thing, a lot of that is just mythologizing. You know, you dig into the facts of that, you know, he was heavily involved with the mob. I mean, Sonny Liston's involvement with the mob, a lot of people suspect his death being tied into the mob, being a mob hit. So I think you're right in the sense that you have the mob's affiliation and corruption and politics always having such a firm control of boxing, very little pushback from boxing itself, because boxing, like the hero of the sport, decade after decade, usually is not anybody whose glove is raised, but it's the money. It's the money is the hero of this sport over and over and over again, because if you're a fighter who's going to make a lot of people more money, there's a lot of people who have a big incentive to keep that going, and the public is not really that aware of the vetting process of how these people get into positions of overseeing the sport. There's no governor or czar or anything, so there's just so little oversight to push back. And, you know, it's not an accident that the sport is compared
sorry,
to the red light district.
I don't mean, like, I'm not laughing at you, but it's just that when I think about it, sometimes I'm just like, this shit is so lawless and totally fucking random, and it's absolutely crazy how much money basically gets laundered through it. It's just nuts. It's just
and always
fucking
has.
Nuts, dude.
And always has. Like, so, I don't think, like,
God.
This is us. This is not us shitting on the sport or shitting on the people participating on it.
I love boxing,
but
it's just, oh my God.
But I mean, that's what I kind of love about it. I mean, in the same way that we are nostalgic for the Wild West and we're recreating a Wild West that really is taken from Japanese feudalistic samurai film. You know, we just reinvent this crazy thing. You know, where Jesse James is kind of, we like little kids pretending to be him and that sort of thing. This is, by the way, a ruthless murderer and robbing trains and killing people left, right, and center. Boxing just appeals to us on that level, that it's something that's impossible to sort of tame. It just seems wild and crazy, and you have the Don Kings of the world plotting from prison after stomping people to death, and very quickly, in short order, is dining with presidents, many presidents, and it doesn't matter what political party they're in. You know, it looks just as good wearing tons of Obama badges on a jean jacket as he does at Trump rallies, or, you know, somebody like Trump using boxing and wrestling, incredibly high visibility. with Tyson's rise and sort of exploiting the glare of the world's attention to assist his own profile, to up his own profile. So boxing will always kind of go wherever there's money, and we see it today that the biggest fights that boxing can offer right now, the most logical place for everybody to throw them at is Saudi Arabia. And is it because, you know, like why is that? Very simple, because the money is there. And if the money is there, it's a moral thing to do. And a lot of journalists will cover it in a positive way because they want access to everything in there so that they can scoop everybody. But underpinning all of that is an unbelievable moral relativism that I don't think any other sport could get away with. I don't think many things could get away with it that are such high-profile public events. So it's if you have a sense of humor, it's just like, wow, like boxing just never lets you down when you think about how low it stoops again and again and again, even when it has incredible investment, venture capital, where they don't have to stoop to this. But they, of course, do anyway. Because why? Because it's boxing.
It's almost paradoxical in its ability to attract or to appeal to both the id and the ego. You know, the id on, like, the base level that it's violence and that it's, you know, even just on a base level aesthetically pleasing. You know, we want to see somebody get fucked up, and that's, like, our brain just says, watch that. Yeah, watch that. And the ego, in the sense that we're perhaps not everybody, but many of us are capable of seeing the poetry in it and seeing the higher art in it. You know, the fucking, the whether it's the aesthetic and physical poetry in it, and or whether it's the art and the irony and whatnot behind it. Behind the curtain, you know, whatever it is, it's simultaneously capable of tickling both of those things at the same time and everything in between. And I think that's one of the great things about it, and kind of trying to get back on course as far as you mentioning Roy Jones versus Sihun Park. I mean, that shit was so bad. And I mean, it was Roy Jones is right to be upset about that shit, because that is pretty much how I felt, you know, watching Emmanuel Augustus versus Courtney Burton, except for Roy Jones was Emmanuel Augustus. Like, he was that guy, and it was on the highest possible level. Or, I mean, I guess it depends on who you ask. Some amateur fighters would say that, you know, like, different world championships would be the pinnacle, but nonetheless, the Olympics basically is. And at the pinnacle, Roy Jones performs splendidly, and somebody just walks up and is like, yoink, right out of his hand with the fucking gold medal. You know, it affected him so deeply that it literally sent shockwaves through his career and affected his decisions, his decision-making, years down the line. And now, you know, they get to a point where the light heavyweight title is fractured and all of the belts are basically with Roy, whereas the lineal title is with Darius Mikulchevsky, and Roy's like, nah, I'm not going overseas. Last time that happened, I got robbed. And that wound up being kind of refrain for him for a few years, and eventually Mikulchevsky was defeated, and it just, you know, blah blah blah. But on some level, I don't disparage, you know, the guy. I get it, but nonetheless, it obviously affected his career. It was bad.
It was terrible. Yeah, and I mean, I think to put some of this stuff, like, just to put a bow on it. I mean, I think one of the greatest lines about corruption in boxing is like Hauser testifying, being asked, you know, is Don King, the most powerful person in the sport, involved in organized crime? And he said, no, I don't think you understand. Don King is organized crime. And this is somebody who controls almost every division in the sport. If you wanted to play ball, you were signing your name to a contract that hadn't been written. Well, what other sport could this happen? What other form of labor in the United States could this happen that isn't, you know, slavery or, you know, just gross exploitation? But in boxing, this was standard. And so, you know, I think Roy and Roy's dad, he had the ability, and I think he had the stubbornness and determination to try to operate outside of all of these cautionary tales that seem to define the sport for being the defining great fighter of his era. But ultimately, you know, how well did it work out for Roy fighting these, you know, regional fights in small arenas? Like, he had to play ball. And it's, I always wonder, like, how is this stuff going to change? I always try to talk to people who are insiders or old timers in the sport. How do they see these changes happening? And they all say the same thing. People have to want to make them. And, you know, for amateur boxing, I wonder, I think you could make a pretty good argument that what happened to Roy in 88, boy, that sends a signal out to every American youth who's thinking about, should I choose boxing or another sport? I mean, if you're one of you're the family of that youth who's on his way, who just looks like an athletic superstar, why the hell would you ever choose a sport where something like this could happen? Where at that time, I think there was the illusion that the IOC and the organizers of the Olympics, like, that this was an upstanding organization and it stands for the values of what the Olympics have always stood for. Utterly corrupt, you know, just as corrupt as anything else in boxing. And, you know, to go to Korea and have three judges, all of them banned from the sport for handing a victory to a kid who had been so dominated in that final as Jones's opponent was, you know, I think you're right. It sent shockwaves through the sport, and I don't know that American Olympic boxing was ever the same. Even what was going to happen with the elevation of Oscar De La Hoya kind of being the last golden boy that boxing produced from the amateur ranks. I mean, you could argue Andre Ward, but it didn't happen for Ward the way it did for De La Hoya. There was a kind of glare to De La Hoya's rise out of the amateurs that we never saw again from the U.S. amateur system. And maybe what happened to Jones is a very good reason why. It was the opposite. It was the ultimate anti-recruitment poster for Olympic boxing, for amateur boxing in the U.S.
How did we go in the 1950s, for instance? And I mean, I definitely want to get another controversy in, but I'm curious if you have any opinion on this, but how did we go in the 1950s, the feds prosecuting the International Boxing Club of New York and basically breaking up a massive monopoly to where we were in the 80s, 90s, and I mean, for the most part, still are. I mean, you have Matchroom and DAZN, you have Top Rank, Golden Boy, Premier Boxing Champions. And I mean, for basically four promotional entities, and I don't mean to discount Main Events or any of the kind of medium-sized promoters or any of the smaller promoters either, but for four or five promotional entities to control that many high-level boxers is, like, that's a monopoly. How did we go from there to here and basically zero progress?
No, I mean, it's an interesting thing. I mean, I've just spent, for my podcast Tourist Information, interviewing a number of people that are from the world of the UFC, and, you know, how did the UFC come out of nowhere and just suddenly gain a higher profile than boxing, where, you know, it has this incredible profile on TV, this incredible recruitment poster with all of its fighters, and turning Dana White into probably the greatest superstar that the UFC ever produced, selling for $4.4 billion to WME. How does it do it? Well, because you can operate out in the open as a monopoly, and these antitrust lawsuits don't really bother the public in any way, and the public doesn't really care if you don't have any long-term champions, you know, because you're matching them in the ways that boxing could only dream of, in terms of they're in serious mortal danger. You know, like they're every Pacquiao Mayweather happening at absolutely when it should happens for every fighter. So consequently, people don't last long and nobody's undefeated with everything. You know, it's a sport that's even more willing to go to that extreme and just and got away with it. Whereas boxing, everybody is just competing in their own interests. There's nobody where the health of the sport is paramount in their thinking, and there's nothing there to incentivize it either. So everything is just short-term gain. So I don't know. It's hard not just to look at, you know, just I think it's just a byproduct of just capitalism and a lot of competing interests looking out for themselves selfishly. And occasionally, like you're saying before, are these things conspiracies or is it idiocy? I personally don't look at much that happens that's important historically where stupidity doesn't seem a much more reasonable answer than conspiracy. I mean, I don't think I'm very effective at conspiring what to have for breakfast on the weekend, let alone, you know, plotting the things that all these people are accused of plotting. I think there's, while you have a lot of really good brains that are in boxing, emotionally, like it's a C student environment. And emotionally, it's like a six-year-old environment. And that's what sort of dominates the way the sport is run. It's run by some pretty petty egomaniacal characters that are kind of the central figures that are controlling the puppet strings.
It's just crazy for it to be a like common knowledge thing. This is not any sort of secret. Like, it's pretty much out in the open, and it's joked about. Everybody knows it, but, you know, but whatever. It's anyway. You bring up Oscar De La Hoya, and he himself has been involved in a couple of controversial decisions. I mean, you have the Trinidad fight. I'm not entirely sure how controversial that was. I don't know. But you also have the Whitaker fight for him too. And some people believed that Ike Quarte could have won their fight. I personally thought Oscar sealed it with the late knockdown. But nonetheless, you mentioned Oscar De La Hoya kind of holding up that next golden boy mantle, both literally and, you know, figuratively with the Olympics and kind of becoming the next superstar. Getting treated a bit more nicely at times than a Roy Jones Jr. So what of De La Hoya's controversies?
Well, I think De La Hoya always had the big advantage. He, for opponents, he'd be a very scary proposition because he was an extraordinarily gifted fighter, but also he was just such an unbelievable, unprecedented moneymaker in terms of what he represented to boxing. I mean, I don't know that you get Floyd Mayweather as we know him as Money Mayweather without that fight with De La Hoya, even though it didn't happen at a really opportune time for Oscar. But I mean, the publicity and what was generated from that, I mean, it put him over, absolutely. And Oscar, you know, with that kind of earning power, you had the perception that judges were always going to kind of side for him in his favor, but that did not happen with Pernell Whitaker. And ultimately, I mean, what are the big fights that Oscar won in his career? It's a real Achilles heel to his legacy that is, talented and great as he was and somebody I don't know in any sports where there has ever been a male athlete where I think the estimates were that 70% of his audience who were paying pay-per-views were female, or it was that for a period of time. I mean, that is just insanity. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of that's comparable to that kind of marketability is where Ronda Rousey just came out of nowhere and became one of the most famous athletes in the world in a sport that was openly misogynistic. I mean, incredibly hostile to women, proudly hostile toward women, and suddenly she's the biggest star that the sport ever produced. So De La Hoya has a lot of these weird decisions. I mean, how did you score? Who did you see winning when he fought Pernell Whitaker?
I definitely thought Pernell Whitaker won that fight, but I also liked Pernell Whitaker even as, like, in his latter day career. It was just starting to be a boxing fan, and I liked Pernell Whitaker. You know, I don't know. I liked him, but it was just a case of Oscar having difficulty really landing clean on Pernell Whitaker, and it's not that Pernell Whitaker, you know, touched him up a ton, but he outpointed him, I thought. Oscar's kind of funny. You know, he definitely had a very interesting career, and it's funny that you say however much the percentage was of his paying audience was female, or women, I'm sorry. I will say, from personal experience, going to Vegas for a fight weekend is definitely a different experience. Now, of course, I've never been to New York, so, or at least not for a fight weekend, so I can't say. But going to Vegas for a fight weekend is kind of like going to Miami Beach on a summer day and just, like, walking around as far as, like, fine women. It's just like, you know, so you go to Vegas and on a big fight weekend, it's like, wow. But then you go to Vegas on a De La Hoya fight weekend and it's like, holy shit. There, like, the amount of fine women was just like, it exploded. And, I mean, you were just talking about misogyny, and I probably sound awful saying that, but I don't know. I hate when people say, I'm just saying, as if that's, like, some sort of explanation, but I am just saying in this instance. In any event, it's true. And that kind of crossover appeal, in terms of, like, gender crossover appeal, is not something you see a whole lot in boxing, especially these days. But even in the 90s, too, that's something that you could see a lot more often in, like, the 30s, 40s, 50s, where boxing was just more of, you know, more adhered to, like, the everyday pop culture. And so you'd be more likely to catch a fighter on the cover of fucking Teen Beat or 17 or something like that, you know, or whatever that era's version of that was. So De La Hoya's crossover appeal was pretty extraordinary. But I mean, trying to keep it somewhat tame, he definitely paid the price for that fame, for sure.
He did. I mean, you know, and I don't think we're trying to be misogynistic in talking about this, but it's just making the point that most of the audience at major press conferences, weigh-ins, and fights is predominantly male. And that was not the case with, like, you watch the tape, you watch these big fights where De La Hoya is having weigh-ins, it's mainly female. You know, he was not winning a Latino Grammy really on the strength of his vocals. Nobody is really looking back saying, you know, De La Hoya really damaged his legacy by not going to his true calling of being a singer, like being the Enrique Iglesias of his time. You know, it's just, he had an image that was immensely powerful in terms of its drawing power for women. And I don't know of another fighter that's really had that. There's definitely, I mean, obviously the major heavyweights have been notorious womanizers and that kind of thing. And there's, you know, Mike Tyson fighting Larry Holmes, where he's got, you know, Robin Givens, who's starring in a, you know, major TV show, like a smash hit. Miss America, Suzette Charles, is in the audience. And then Naomi Campbell, one of the most beautiful supermodels ever. You know, he was pretty desirable from extraordinarily high profile women, like globally. But De La Hoya was on a different level. He was just on a different level. And I don't know, I mean, like, when you're being compared to Rudolph Valentino, one of the greatest sex symbols that Hollywood has ever produced, like, you're in a special category of athlete. And you know, LeBron James is not being compared to Rudolph Valentino, or Denzel Washington. You know, he has a lot of other marketable features, but he's, you know, not in that area. So De La Hoya was in a kind of special place that I don't know too many athletes have ever occupied.
Yeah, not quite Wilt Chamberlain, but I think he was, I think he had aspirations.
Yeah.
And I can, I admire them.
You have to. We're positive here. We're sex positive.
But I'll tell you one thing, though. He's no Bobby Chez.
He's no Bobby. No, I mean, now you're just getting to the absolute apogee of sex appeal of athletes.
Yeah.
And not just athletes,
pinnacle.
But thinkers.
Yeah, pinnacle.
Thinkers.
Peak, zenith.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean, how many people can occupy two pantheons, that he's on the one of greatest looking athletes of all time, while simultaneously being arguably the greatest, I don't even think there's an argument, undisputably the greatest looking thinker that the world's ever produced? I mean, put him up against Einstein or Goethe, Stephen Hawking, Chez is just going to get behind the wheel, drunk out of his head, and just drive over them.
Yeah, like I said, zenith, but like a television, like zenith television, not like, you know.
Absolutely.
Like, I need help. This coronavirus shit has gotten to me, Bryn. It's gotten to me. Oh, God. How are you holding up, by the way?
I'm okay. I mean, I'm 2 months in. 30 miles north of New York City, it's still kind of hard to wrap my head around that my adoptive town is the global epicenter, where I'm in a country that has 4% of the world's population and a third of the world's deaths and infections, and about four blocks from where I live in Washington Heights is the Presbyterian Hospital, which is, you know, ground zero for people being treated in New York City. So it was, it's just, on the one hand, it kind of feels like a day home from school, you know, a storm or snowfall keeping you home. And in another way, it's just amazing to me how many people have lost their lives or been impacted from this or lost family members. And like the woman that I'm staying with here, we've gone to deliver some food to her parents a few times, and to not be able to get out and hug your parents or your brother, or, you know, it's hard for me to look ahead and understand not just when this goes back to normal, but really coming to grips with that it's not going to go back to normal, and that 30 million people are unemployed right now. And one in five kids in the wealthiest country in the world don't have enough to eat. This is a lot for, I think, people who care about this country to deal with, to see where we are when we're really confronted with adversity that's not figurative or metaphorical or the threat of immigrants or whatever. But this is how we're handling stuff right now. It just shows that, like, maybe some positive changes need to happen, I think. What about you?
We're doing okay. We're, you know, keeping busy by trying to learn and do useful things. We built a chicken coop, or at least we're in the process of building a chicken coop. We're almost done. We've just been kind of hampered by rain, so we haven't been able to build. But nonetheless, you know, just things that are, I guess, useful, especially now, that we're saving money is kind of paramount, and people need to learn how to acquire skills that are necessary in day-to-day life that don't just have to do with social media and shit like that. But, you know, it's definitely, I guess the only way I can describe it is strange. It's just weird, man. It's, I guess looking back, it was something that was probably inevitable, but to actually see it play out is pretty crazy. And it's definitely disheartening to see much of what's going on. But I, and it's also, it's frustrating to not have much power over it, of course, but that's, just part of life, I guess. Yeah, it's weird, dude. It's definitely very weird. We've thus far luckily been very fortunate, but, one, I'm kind of a cynic. Two, I tend to be a little bit pessimistic and dwell on things. And, you know, I think during a lot of this, I just cannot help but think about people who are not fortunate. And like I said, we have been, and I'm very thankful that we have been. But there are a lot of people who have not been, and that's, and a lot of kids who have not been. And that's, that weighs, you know. It definitely does.
Yeah, I mean, it's odd to be living through a time that I think, you know, after we're gone, people are going to look back on this, and it's just going to be unreal that this was a, you know, that it was normal for a period of time. I mean, it also allows us to kind of look back at, I always wondered what it was like for my grandfather to have five kids during the Depression, where, you know, he was moving all over the province of British Columbia, getting offered work. He was a logger and worked in sawmills and that sort of thing. And, you know, get offered 2 weeks or 3 weeks work or a month or two. And then a boss just say, you know what, fuck you, I'm not going to pay you. And to confront, like, how do I, you know, there's no credit cards. How do I feed my children? How do I deal with this? And you're seeing a lot of people now where, like, we're in a position, I'm living in one of the wealthiest cities in the world, and I have no idea how a lot of people are going to pay the rent. Because, I mean, I don't even know how 96% of them in April paid the rent, but they did. And they probably maxed out their credit cards to do it because they don't have any work, and they don't know if their work is ever going to come back. And I don't know what the month of May is like as far as being able to pay that. And the best that government has been able to come up with is for 3 months, your landlord can't evict you, as if that makes any difference to you not being able to work over that period of time and still owing these bills. So it's, there's just so many moving pieces to this and so little clarity of leadership about how to address these problems that are asteroids coming at a lot of families' lives. And, you know, so yeah, look, I hear what you're saying, and I'm trying to do the same. Is, you know, I don't know, one of the ways that I make ends meet is teaching people to box, but anybody who is in the service industry as a bartender or a waiter that I was training, like, they don't know when their jobs are coming back or if they're coming back, because if they weren't working at McDonald's or like a major chain, any small business has probably gone under permanently, or lots of them have gone under permanently. So it's pretty scary to see where this could all unfold when people, I think, really come to grips with the reality that, you know, we're dealing with numbers of unemployed people and the economic impact of this that in some ways, by some metrics, is worse than the Depression. And we don't have FDR ready, at the ready, with the New Deal to address these problems. And we kind of need somebody who is in a position intellectually and has the political will to try to help. And there's so much distrust in these institutions that I don't know how we come out of this. I'm not saying we can't. I just don't know how we do. And that's an odd feeling in a country this powerful and this wealthy.
Yeah, like you said, odd. It's very surreal, for sure. But nonetheless, we're living in reality. But hopefully, you know, these little breaks from reality, you know, that we're trying to provide with these history episodes and whatnot are helping. I can definitely tell you they're helping me. Hopefully they're helping you. So it's all we can really do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the real leader who needs to emerge, we both know who he is. He's in New Jersey right now. And until Bobby Chess steps up to the plate, I mean, I think regardless of the veracity of these allegations against Joe Biden right now, from Tara Reid, we need a third candidate, or maybe it's a fourth candidate. I think there is a third candidate who announced. That fourth candidate is Bobby Chez.
The Passaic puncher himself.
Chappie.
Yep, I'd vote for him in a heartbeat.
I'd vote for his mustache. Even if he shaved off his mustache and ran it as the fifth candidate, his mustache could be his vice president.
Probably do better in the debates than Joe Biden, but I'm sorry. Yeah, sorry. That's probably getting too political for people, but it's true.
Yeah, we're degenerating.
But in any event, it was a somewhat short episode, but we'll definitely be back with more history stuff. And for everybody who stuck with us there at the end as we got a little bit more grim, sorry, but hey, man, we got to talk about some real life shit too every so often. And nonetheless, we appreciate it, and we thank you for tuning in. Brent, I appreciate you taking your time, man.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. Yeah, I hope you and your family are safe, and everybody else is listening in. And yeah, we're just trying to offer a little distraction.
And speaking of which, I know that a lot of people, since the dreaded quarantine has began, a lot of people have turned to podcasts and stuff like that. And some people listening in, I don't even think I've mentioned it before, which is my bad, but some people listening in might not be aware that you have another podcast for The Ring called Tourist Information. You've interviewed a number of well-known boxing and not-so-boxing figures and have talked kind of in-depth about a number of somewhat complex things, which is really right up my alley. And I think that if you enjoy listening to Bryn and I talk, it probably will be up your alley too, because, we're not the average boxing podcast in terms of conversation, I think. So again, Tourist Information, go look that up and give that a subscribe. But in the meanwhile, if you're on Twitter, if you would, please also follow Bryn at Brynicio, Brynicio, and also follow me, Patrick Connor, at Patrick M. Connor. And if you're on Facebook, go to the Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio page on Facebook. And also, I'm starting to get old because I'm like, go to the iTunes, go to the Skype Skittles and, all the shit, whatever, Spotify. Yeah, I don't even know what's going on anymore these days, dude. What day is it? Anyway, all of these podcasting apps, Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio is on there. Give us a subscribe, a rating, all that type of stuff. We appreciate it. And Bryn, I'll talk to you soon, bro.
You too, man. Thanks for the little blurb for Tourist Information. Take care, everybody.
For sure. All right. Take it easy, everybody.